It is about 9 minutes before the hour of 6 o'clock. Of course, you're tuned to the Roadhouse here on WTIP. We want to thank you for joining us, and we've got a familiar voice. At least he's been on the Roadhouse before. He's a great author, a journalist, and author. He's written a book here just a short time ago, about 2 years kayaking around Lake Superior, called Wild Shore. His most recent book is called Paddle North, Canoeing the Boundary Waters, Quetico Wilderness. And he also has a book called Super Volcano, the story of the active volcano beneath Yellowstone that could wipe out about a sixth of the world's population if it ever decided to go. He's worked with another familiar name around this area, Lane Kennedy. And he's just written an article that was published in the magazine of the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota. And that article has to do with another aspect of climate change, at least partly, that species are increasingly interbreeding to survive. And Greg, I want to welcome you back to the Roadhouse.
Well, thank you very much, Buck. Glad to be here.
You know, I thought it was, as soon as I saw the name of that article, of course, we've heard of stories about a number of different breeds out there, but you've kind of really connected a lot of dots here with this article. How did you decide to focus in on this?
Well, gosh, a good question. You know how these ideas seep into one's brain? You never really are aware until, lo and behold, there it is. I guess from reading a lot of science stories about the potential for different species to interbreed. We tend to think of species as being these discrete little pigeonholes. You know, you just they're separate, and so they shall remain. But as scientists have been able to do gene sequencing within the last decade or so, they've discovered that a lot of species have been mixing it up for a long time, including humans, mixing with the Neanderthals, of all things. So,
yeah, I'd have to agree. My thought processes as I grew up and was educated was that species were kind of inviolate. You know, they are who they are, and they don't interbreed with anybody else.
Right, right. And, of course, that is what happens most of the time. That's why we recognize them as discrete species, but creatures are sneaky that way.
I guess
they cross species boundaries from time to time, and we're only beginning to discover that now.
Mm-hmm. Well, some scientists seem to be sort of, I shouldn't say welcoming, but not so afraid of the consequences, while others are kind of worried about extinction of various species that we still have here.
Sure, and I think that's typical of a lot of issues in science. You have people who tend to be more on the catastrophist side, who see every new development as a potential disaster, and then you have people more on the libertarian side, who see each new development is something exciting to explore, and that is the case here as well. Some scientists are concerned that, for example, mixing subspecies will extinguish locally adapted populations, and the classic case are the rainbow trout and cutthroat trout out in the American West. As they hybridize, fishery scientists there fear that we are losing a distinctive breed in the West Loke cutthroat trout, and they're probably right. We may be losing that. On the other hand, other scientists see examples of wonderfully adapted mongrels, if you will, and a classic case that is something that you guys may be familiar with up there are coyotes, or what in Minnesota we call brush wolves. And as western coyotes have moved east to sort of fill the space left by the eradication of wolves, they interbred with wolves up along the north shore of the Great Lakes in Canada. And so by the time they arrived out in Minnesota, but even more so out in New York and Pennsylvania, they had a big hunk of wolf in them. And so, they were 30-40% bigger than western coyotes, and now they're big enough to drag down the deer that are proliferating out in New England and in New York, and they're sort of filling that spot of apex predator.
You know, from my own experience, I've shown a photo of a wolf slash coyote. I wasn't sure which it was.
Hard to tell sometimes.
Yeah, to wildlife people here at that work for the state up in our area, and they couldn't tell me.
Yeah. Well, this so-called coy wolf or eastern coyote, may run 40, even 50 pounds with a much more massive head than its ancestor out in the, out in the cowboy west. And so they're much more suited to pulling down white-tailed deer, but they seem to have retained a lot of that coyote stealth. So unlike timber wolves, they seem much more adept at living in suburbs and even in cities. So they've really capitalized on the best of both worlds.
I found it interesting, just keeping on coyotes, the what you wrote about what's happening in North Carolina with an effort to protect the endangered red wolf.
Yes. Well, the red wolf is a funny creature. It's kind of an intermediate itself. Scientists classified as a separate species, Canis rufus, but it really seemed to develop from a common ancestor with the coyote and the eastern timber wolf, and so it's a bit of a mix itself. Well, these things went extinct or in the wild back in about 1980 or so, and wildlife managers went to reintroduce them. And what the wildlife managers hadn't realized is how prevalent coyotes had become even out on the eastern seaboard in recent years, and so they plunked these red wolves down in a national wildlife refuge, and suddenly they're interbreeding like crazy with the coyotes out there and are in danger of losing this distinctive red wolf genome. And so they have sterilized coyotes and released them into the area to allow the sterile coyotes to defend territories against fertile coyotes. And they're still trying this, not with complete success, by the way. So the future of that program is a little bit up in the air.
Now, just while we're talking about that, is this something that, what's your feelings on that? Should we be interfering with, of course, we already interfere when we reintroduce the red wolf.
Sure, we interfere with everything all the time anyway, so,
yeah.
In a sense, we can't be too pristine about this. I mean, when you're changing climate, you're altering habitat, that is, when humans are doing that, we are sort of setting the stage for a big mixing of species anyway. So undoubtedly, this sort of thing will continue, and in fact, it may help some species, like this coyote-wolf mix, to adapt to new situations. That's a good thing. On the other hand, in certain circumstances, like the western cutthroat trout and the rainbow, the upshot may not be so desirable. And so I guess we have to pick our battles. Unfortunately, conservation policy kind of lags behind the emerging science here. And so we've got some catching up to do to decide if we want to treat hybrids as valuable things to conservation or things that should be eradicated when possible. We're still trying to tussle with that.
In this area, we have bobcats hybridizing with lynx.
Yes.
And of course, they are, even though they're both cats here, there's quite a bit of useful features that are different between the two, with the lynx and the big feet and the small weight for the size of body to stay on snow to catch rabbits, and bobcats
right.
A little more compact and smaller feet. Is that, who knows how that's going to pan out, huh?
Who knows how it's going to pan out? And one of the baffling things is that bobcats and lynx coexist in the Rocky Mountains, where they don't seem to hybridize at all, which leaves scientists wondering, why do they not hybridize? Why do they remain separate in the mountainous West? Why do they seem to hybridize rather freely here in the Midwest? Likewise, coyotes and wolves out West don't hybridize.
Must be something in the water here.
Well, who knows? Is it an issue of topography? Is it something else going on with other species? Who knows? That really hasn't been discovered yet.
I kind of led into this conversation talking a little bit about global warming, and maybe you could give some instances of how that may be bringing different species together.
Well, for example, with the rainbow and the cutthroat trout, the rainbow cross with cutthroat is something they call a cutbow. And apparently it doesn't have quite the cold water tolerance of the cutthroat trout. But as mountain streams get warmer, as precipitation declines and the volume of the streams declines, these cutbows are able, apparently more easily, to spread into farther upstream reaches of these rivers. And so the opportunity for hybridization is greater. As grizzly bears and polar bears, operate in a changing habitat in the Arctic, perhaps, and this isn't clear yet, but perhaps they'll come into contact more frequently. Already they do once in a while, and they occasionally cross, giving birth to something called a pizzly bear. So just with the sort of chaos from global warming, as things are moving, trying to find more suitable habitat, both plants and animals, scientists expect that we will see these kinds of things more often.
Yeah, I hope they come up with a better name than pizzly bear.
Don't you? I love pizzly bear.
You like that one?
I do.
It just sounds too wimpy for those things. We're speaking with Greg Brining, and Greg is a journalist and author, and we're talking about global warming and interbreeding and how that relates to the big world out there right now. And we talked earlier about that this hybridizing may have it is not new necessarily. It's been going on probably for a long time, and you just mentioned the grizzly bear and the polar bear. That happened earlier in history.
Yes, it did. Again, through genetic sequencing, scientists can go back and look at the introgression of some of these genes into species, and they seem to think that the now extinct Irish brown bear, which is really the same species as a grizzly, interbred with polar bears, back in the last ice age. In fact, the dark pelage of a lot of wolves in the forest here in North America seems to be a trait that was acquired from domestic dogs. And not recently, but perhaps 14,000 years ago when humans came across the Bering Land Bridge. So there's a long history of this stuff. And in fact, there's some evidence that humans, that is European humans, acquired some aspects of skin coloration, and that people on the Tibetan Plateau, for example, acquired adaptations to high altitude from some of our early hominid forebears, Neanderthals and Denisovians. So, yeah, this kind of stuff has been going on for a long time.
Now, as I went through school, I was kind of taught that evolution happened through mutations. But it sounds like this interbreeding and hybridizing could be a big factor as well.
Well, it's like a big grab bag. You know, suddenly an animal like a coyote can grab a big bunch of variation by interbreeding with something else. For example, gain an increase in stature and skull size far more quickly than it could by depending on its own innate variability. It's really another evolutionary tool.
I imagine that there's these are subspecies kind of that are getting together, and there must be instances where that just can't work.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you can only cross a gulf so great and expect the offspring to be fertile. So, this bridge goes only so far between subspecies, or in some cases between closely related species like lynx and bobcats, coyotes and wolves, things like that.
Are there any other practical, and some of these may not be practical, even the cutthroat and rainbow thing can maybe be held in check with some human diversions, but are there other practical real-world actions that scientists might take to keep other species pure, or is there really a reason to do that?
Well, it's sort of like the situation with invasive species. I mean, some of it just comes with the territory of people traveling and moving things about, and you're never going to put a lid on it entirely. But on the other hand, there are certain situations where you would like to stop it if you can. For example, the state of Montana long ago quit stocking rainbow trout in most of its streams as an effort to stop this kind of hybridization, realizing that it's something that they probably didn't want. Now, on the other hand, coyotes and wolves and so-called coy wolves out in New England, I don't know how you're going to stop that. That's just, you know, one of those facts of life. And really, it's kind of a fascinating thing that we can learn from.
Mm-hmm. And much of the fear is just a loss of biodiversity.
Yeah, some people would say it's an increase in biodiversity, mm-hmm. That you're really increasing the adaptability of certain organisms, and that is a good thing, that ultimately will contribute to biodiversity. To some extent, it's out of our hands. You know, it's hard to know how to react to some of this stuff, some of it we can't prevent, no matter how hard we would try.
You know, I mentioned earlier that your article's in a magazine of the Institute of on the Environment. Where can people find your article on the web?
Well, the easiest way is just go online and go to ENSEA.com, and you'll see a passel of great stuff to read about the environment. One of the things I really love about ENSEA magazine is that it's not a doom and gloom environmental magazine at all. They're always looking for solutions. They're looking for real science, and it's fascinating for that reason. If they want to look for my story, they can just look up coy wolves or coyotes and wolves, and it'll pop up.
Or maybe even put your name in there, and
they could do that.
Something will pop up. Yeah. What have you got going right now, Greg? Have you got something, a new book or a new project in mind?
A project, yes. I plan to go fishing. It's fishing season.
That sounds like a great project.
Actually, it's funny that we should be having this conversation, because I'm actually working on a similar but longer and more involved story on the same topic of our mongrel world, if you will, for National Wildlife Magazine.
Hmm. So you'll be coming out with a more comprehensive article?
A different, more comprehensive article with some more examples, and there are lots of them. So it's a pretty fascinating topic.
It sure is. We've been speaking with Greg Brining, and Greg, of course, is a journalist and author. He spent a considerable amount of time up in our neck of the woods and talking about interbreeding due to many different factors, but interbreeding in the natural world and where it can lead. And, Greg, I want to thank you again so much for joining us here tonight, and we look forward to wherever the world leads you and reading about it.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It was my pleasure.